Skeptia Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.
The program, co-hosted by myself, Andre Lopez Turner, with Juan Toledo, in association with xradio1.com and Artifacto, welcomes Martin Friedman, financial analyst and sound engineer, into the studio tonight to talk about the economics of Brexit. Thank you very much for gracing us with your presence. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Andre and Juan. I'm considering this more like a little roundtable discussion rather than a specific interview for me. I'm, in some sense, an amateur. I'm interested in the topic. I've spent many years researching it. I feel like I know not more than a lot of the MPs and a lot of the pundits who are on TV all the time, but I'm by no means an expert. Mm-hmm. On my Twitter profile, I say I am not an economist, I'm a realist. So let's just shoot the breeze.
Well, that's exactly why you're here, because you're knowledgeable and humble and a good man. So thanks very much again. I'm just going to open it up to be really general, just to start, because, you know, who knows where we go. But most of us in the public are told that if you leave the European Union, it will be a magnificent thing for the country, and the economy will be, boom.
If you leave?
No, sorry.
Yes. Well, both sides of the argument. One says that it's an opportunity for the country, and the other one would say it's a disaster. So
yeah, and then the other side say that can't happen because it will be an absolute disaster. This place will implode. And I was wondering, where do we stand on this? Because, you know, if we leave with the WTO Brexit, as I understand, the tariff barriers will be lower than they are in the EU, and we will actually be able to trade with the world. So therefore, the argument, well, is not necessarily true.
Well, there's lots of nuance in this, and one of the problems is, I think, is it's overly simplified in the public discourse. So my position in all this is a little bit peculiar compared to, say, most people who look at the public debate. In my position, I have people. I am of the left with a small L, not a capital L, but the people to the left of me are what I call hard Lexiters, and they make an argument, not necessarily a socialist argument, they may be of a socialist bent, but certainly of a view very critical of the structures, not just of the EU, but also the IMF, the World Bank, and even the WTO itself, as being part of a grand neoliberal project. And I agree with them broadly. And on my right, at least historically, since, say, the time of the Greek financial crisis, the Greek sovereign debt crisis, I've looked at the way that Greece was treated, and that's obviously a separate topic which we can get into if we want to. But in my view, Greece was very badly treated, and it was a litmus test. It's something I'd expected for like 15 years, since I was a currency trader in the early 90s, and I was looking to understand the creation of the euro. I was interested in terms of financial trading and investment purposes. When you're trading German Deutschmark and Swiss franc, well, no, that's not the euro, the French franc and Spanish lira and so on, and how you model the euro when all these currencies come together. And at that time, it was blindingly obvious that the way it was designed, well, it wasn't blindingly obvious, I'm sorry, it actually wasn't. Took a lot of work to find out, particularly from a British economist called Wynne Godley, that the nature of the structure would be such that the largest debtor nations would have huge problems in relation to the largest surplus nations. Now, if there had been the principle of the EU principle of subsidiarity and general solidarity, they would have fixed that. Instead, they went the other way and made things much worse. To me, that was a litmus test. It was entirely predictable a country would be in that situation. I did not know which one. I wasn't, by that time, a trader, so I wasn't paying full attention to that. And it happened to be Greece. And then you saw all the the victim blaming of Greece and all sorts of other stuff. It would have happened to, could have happened to Spain.
Exactly. It could happen to southern countries. Yes. Italy, Spain, Portugal.
It doesn't have to be. It happened to be the southerns, just because their economies are so different to the northerns. But it would happen to a country, given the design of the EU, of the Eurozone, and of the Euro. And so, at that point in time, and I looked at what happened with Greece, to me that was a litmus test or a canary in the mine telling me that this the Euro project, the European project, as represented by the European Union, is not going to work, it's gone awry. And other people might agree with my analysis of Greece and still come to a different conclusion about that. Merely understanding the economics, or even agreeing with me on an economic analysis in these areas, doesn't mean you're going to come to the same political conclusions. But that was my conclusion. And in that frame, at that point in discussion, was the alternative to the European Union was EFTA, the European Free Trade Association, of which the UK was the founder member before we joined the European Economic Community, and the European Economic Association, which was formed in the late 90s with the growth from the Single European Act and then the Single Market, and that was an alternative path. Originally, it was the EEA was expected to be a path for nations that weren't yet ready to join into the EU. They would, it would be an intermediate or transitory stage, but it's also an exit path, and that was pretty much understood by anyone who was concerned about this topic as the reasonable exit path. It was reflected in a lot of the discussions prior to the referendum. I mean, I knew this and was aware of this, but didn't necessarily investigate it the right way, years before the referendum was mooted. I was concerned that we never had a referendum over the European Constitution, which Tony Blair promised and then reneged on. And that happened in three different countries, twice they had to vote, they rejected and then accepted it, and Ireland and so on. So it's always expected you can have a referendum and you don't get the right result, there's going to be another vote. There's something very, very peculiar, to put it politely, about the whole process. Is it a democracy? Yeah. Get it wrong, no good, have another vote. So that's where I came from. It was always EFTA, EEA. And even then I was aware of some discussions of things like Northern Ireland. Maybe, again, not to the depth that we've all explored, but they all were considered. And, you know, when I speak to civil servants then and now, it's always the preferred option of many people in many different departments in the civil service, whether it's DTI or the Treasury and so on, or the Home Office, particular groups or people I've met. So that was on my right. At the same time, also, when you're looking at a solution to the problem, you're inevitably going to be looking and working with people who have different politics to you and different economics, because my view is just one view out of many, and even there's quite a few may actually, if they knew about it, agree with me, or I would agree with whoever, you know, the founders of various approaches. You're always going to have consensus. You're going to have people across the spectrum who want this, and they're going to have different motives, different motivations for the same outcome. And there could be benefits to that, and there could be dangers to that. But you're always so. In my position, on my left, there were people arguing more for a WTO Brexit, concerned over the state aid rules, the government procurement rules, the state ownership rules of the EU. They also exist to a lesser degree in the WTO. Mm-hmm. The three protocols of the WTO mostly were initiated by the EU itself. So I've looked at that. So my position is probably a bit opposite, flipped to lots of other people who might look at it the other way. But the only one point I want to make from that is you're dealing with a spectrum of views and a spectrum of motivations. I fully recognise that people from the left or the right or the centre could want to stay in the EU and have serious, good arguments. Similarly, from the left, right and centre want to leave the EU in all shape and form, and others want some form of compromise in between. It is interesting that the strongest arguments for a WTO Brexit as a first choice, an option A, was actually from the Lexiters. It never was from the main campaigners that we are familiar with, that we know of. They often, you know, would make arguments we could be like Norway, we could remain in the single market. Prior to the referendum, there was very little talk from many of the most vocal pundits and various leaders of anything to do with that. All the talk was actually coming from the Lexiters, and they didn't get much publicity.
It's quite interesting what you're saying about your position has changed, has shifted. Mine has shifted too, and I presume it has happened to many people. I think you've got two aspects. You've got a political project, which is the European Union per se, and then you've got an economic project to go with it. And it's about creating a single currency, the euro. And then we, after all these years, after almost 20 years of the euro now, we started to see the structural problems with the euro. Who has benefited from the euro? Most people would say Germany, which is has a major surplus and is a country that produces goods, and the German goods became cheap for the rest of Europe. Many countries borrow money from the European Central Bank very cheaply with very low interest rates for infrastructure projects. Happening in Spain, happening in this country, happening in Greece, in many other parts. But the economy of North Europe is very different from the Southern Europe. That's something that has never been balanced out. But on top of that, you got the emergence of the Asian markets and China being a major, major player. So then imagine you got countries like Belgium, I'm thinking of a country like the Netherlands, very small countries, efficient societies, that they are much better being part of a bloc that has a representation of power with countries like China and the United States and other parts of the world that just by themselves with WTO rules. And I think the argument, perhaps, I still remain a remainer, and I think it's about Britain trying to negotiate with those big partners around the world under the condition in which they can get a good deal with those countries. However, I can see that what happened is you got a globalized market that is starting to fall into certain blocks. The Americans want their own block with Canada and Mexico, although now we got Trump renegating against that. But at the same time, it's the working conditions that happens, the quality of the production, the certain elements that are part of the deal too, things like ecology, things like about workers' rights, and many other legislation which is part now of the fabric of being an European nation. Those are important too. My problem that I have, and it's a question to you, is this. To what extent the economic indicators are real in the terms of the things which are more important? In other words, is not the social reality and the quality of the living of the citizens of a place much more important than the GDP or greater production percentages, etc., etc.? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, well, you've raised a number of things that I could respond to and trying to get some focus. One of the things you mentioned was about worker rights and so on. And the, you know, the fact is, a lot of the rights we actually obtained in this country as a nation state through various acts of parliament, we haven't particularly benefited from these European worker rights, the workers' directives. You know, something you can opt out of. You look also like when Trudeau in Canada was trying to negotiate with China, one of the things they were trying to do in his trade deal was bring about some basic health and safety and human rights aspects, focusing on the health and safety side, and China just said, forget it. The EU has negotiated all these, you know, outside, above the WTA, which is just a rules-based membership club, you know, with preferential trade agreements or free trade agreements. They're certainly not normally fair trade agreements. They're not imposing minimum working standards or health and safety with the rest of the world.
Who isn't?
The EU, as far as I know, in any of its preferential trade, doesn't impose minimum working hours or specify health and safety or anything for anyone producing products that they're going to sell into this country,
so that's
into Europe.
Political hypocrisy, almost.
I agree.
Massive. So can I just sort of...
That's one point. Lots more,
because, there's so much being discussed and going to be discussed now. Just to come back a little bit, just if we can have a little try on the argument, you know, who's going to win? Is it going to be a disaster? Is it not? Do we sort of not know?
Well, yeah, I think the answer is we don't know. There's some things we do know. I think there's huge naivety in a pure WTO deal. And the problem is that the economic arguments are actually dubious, and they're not the be-all and the end-all. There's a number of reasons the economic arguments are dubious. With a background as a quantitative modeler in finance, it's incredibly difficult to model the markets, even on a short-term basis, let alone a long-term basis. There are people all over the world with PhDs in astrophysics and working on this thing using well-nigh supercomputers and nanosecond responsive technologies to actually characterize and create a small edge. It's very difficult to predict anything. And now you're asking economists to be forecasters, and people have too much faith that they can actually be forecasters, and they actually have a terrible record.
Cool, I agree. So can we narrow it down? If we talk about the World Trade Organization, which stands for Global Free Trade, which means tariffs, which are taxes on things which you come into your country.
It's more fairness. It's the idea is you can't discriminate.
Yeah.
That's the key thing of it.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm just trying to sort of narrow it down or make it a little bit clearer. Yeah, the idea that we have free trade where comparative advantage, one country does what they do well, the other country does what they do well, and they trade supposedly freely with the aspiration of being fair as well, which is supervised by the World Trade Organization, sort of does and doesn't happen. Right? We know that, yeah? And then we're told, well, I'm told, and I'm sure you know more than me, and the European Union effectively is another free trade bloc. But if you're not in the European Union, i.e. you're from the South Pacific or Africa
or Latin America,
it's different again. So there are trade barriers up there. So this whole thing about free trade and fair trade, and then on top of it, I'll just put this on to the side, the economic union, everyone's in the euro, but actually England have never been in the euro because we've kept the pound. So I guess, I'm going all over the place, but England has never really been, to a great extent, in the European Union in the currency. And why, in my opinion, is because that gives you an advantage if you are a currency trader. Yes or no?
Well, there is definitely an advantage to having your own sovereign currency.
Yeah.
If you're monetarily sovereign, if you basically you have a monopoly on your own currency, you can pay your debt back in your own currency. If you have sufficient food and energy resources that you're not dependent on borrowing in a foreign currency, and the currency is not convertible, there's lots of advantages. This is something that all the Eurozone countries gave up, and as a consequence they have very limited fiscal tools available when their economy is distressed.
Thank you, because if you look at, say, if we just choose Greece, under the old rules, when you're not in that currency union, you have your currency, which is lower in value than the other one. So effectively, the prescription from the IMF and the World Trade Organization is often you can use that to trade yourself out of trouble, right?
I wouldn't call it a prescription as such, and the IMF itself interferes in a much more proactive fashion. For example, the completely unnecessary IMF loan in the 70s under Healey Callaghan, which was really the beginning of neoliberalism in this country, was actually under a Labour government with Dennis Healey introducing essentially what we could now call neoliberalism. So it's not, it's not a prescription. The WTA is a rules-based membership club, right? And there are various means of surveillance and adjudication when those rules are broken, and they often take years. It's a very different system inside the EU. Now, the EU is a distinct entity. Within that is the Eurozone. Clearly, the intention is for all EU members to be all Eurozone members. And, for example, Sweden doesn't want to have the euro. There are automatic triggers that force countries that aren't in the euro to join the euro, and Sweden keeps on fiddling the numbers so it doesn't have to join the euro. The mere fact that countries are doing this is already, is always saying, well, they're gaming the system, and in Sweden's case, quite correctly, in my view. The euro is a major, but not only factor in the problems of the EU.
Can I just jump in? Sorry, just because I've got a little brainwave here, just to try and narrow it down. In your opinion, why do the Brexiteers, not the Lexiteers, the Brexiteers, who are traditionally from the Conservative Party and the right, UKIP and the Brexit Party, why do they want to Brexit, in your opinion?
And well, in my opinion, I have to
four barrels.
Four barrels. You have to go
You have to go back
to the joining the European Economic Community was a Tory project in the '60s, rejected by de Gaulle twice. Labour was strongly against it.
Well, Labour took them out of the EU, and the Tories joined the EU. I mean, people didn't forget that.
What happened was we joined the European Economic Community,
EEC,
and then it became the EC and then the EU in 1973. Then we had the first referendum in 1975, and Labour was then in power, and at that time they broke this idea of, was it cabinet, I can't remember the term, cabinet responsibility. Every cabinet member could say whether they wanted to stay or leave. And it was the beginning of the split of the Labour Party, which finally manifested in 1981 with the budding off of the Social Democratic Party that eventually merged with the Liberals to become the Liberal Democrats. And that was a major factor with the split vote in why Thatcher got back into power in 1983. Now we go, so that the split, you see, what do you understand? Well, why did Labour split? What, you know, and I give a characterization, and maybe it's the distinction is more important than the labels, but I call them the Benite or neo-Benite democratic socialists. They're, you know, what we understand, the European understanding of socialism, a democratic process to lead to a post-capitalist economy, versus social democrats. Mm. And social democrats believing in a mixed economy, a market, mixed market with government involvement economy, where you want to have is capitalism but with a nicer face, and there's lots of very good things you can do of social purpose as well as just for private sectors. Now that was the split there between the democratic socialists and the social democrats. So I looked at conservatives, my theory, and I haven't really shared it with many people, and I might be completely wrong, is you look at it as, I see the EU as at its core, particularly with Maastricht, or the Single European Act, Maastricht and Lisbon, as it's now got what we call neoliberalism in its DNA, in its core, in the built into the treaties. And that, I think, is very appealing to many conservatives, conservative neoliberals, for want of a better expression. And they like that. It enables them to protect the markets and deal with whatever other the political values to do with the other aspects of society. But their hands are tied. They are tied in a way they want their hands to be tied. It's like, here, put these handcuffs on me, thank you, because now I say I can't go here, and I don't want to go here, but now I say, now I can blame it on the EU or IMF and so on. And so they're all very happy with it. It's a neoliberal wet dream. But neoliberalism itself came from sort of two origins, from the 30s as a solution to the Great Depression, and deciding that the cause of the Great Depression wasn't the free markets running amok and self-destructing, but it was government interference. So neoliberalism came about from Hayek and various other, typically Austrian economists, not necessarily from Austria, and, you know, the Montpellier in the 50s, and Milton Friedman got involved. Then from Milton Friedman it became also not just the Austrian economists, which is a very minor blip in academia, although they have far bigger presence on the internet, but conventional, classical, mainstream, neoclassical, New Keynesian, new classical, real business cycle theory economists. They all sort of, as an underpinning, neoliberalism is a political ideology. And it's an ideology that says we want to manage the legislative and judicial and possibly executive processes of a nation state to protect the markets, to enable them to fully function efficiently, inverted commas, quote unquote, from popular democracy. And the EU, the structures of the EU, the structure of the single market, and many other structures in the Eurozone are tailor-made for that. Now, there's a tension between sort of the Austrian libertarian real belief in free markets goes possibly beyond the Austrian type of approach. There's a tension between that, and this is what split asunder. So I would characterize it as the conservative neoliberals want to stay in the EU, and the libertarian free marketeers want to leave the EU. And you can say, oh, one's less right and one's further right. Sometimes I think these sort of descriptions are misleading, don't really help much. You know,
I think there's another element.
I don't know if that helps.
It does help. Well, I'll tell you what is very useful. You remind me of two things. Europe has split both the Labour Party to start with, and you talk about the SDP, and now the Tory Party. In the current version of the problem that we have with Europe is the Conservative Party projecting that problem that they have with Europe through UKIP, for example, to the nation, and then the referendum. But there's another element with the free market that you talk about, and it's, I would call it Reaganism, and came from the United States, and it's about the size of the state. When Reagan says that the state is not the solution, is the problem, and there should be less state, I think that you got a group of politicians, particularly in the right, in the Conservative Party, thinking about, okay, we can benefit from selling part of the state. I mean, like what happened in Russia. And you see it all the time in the neoliberal model. You see these kind of privatizing companies that belong to the state, offering the free markets to participate in the delivery of services. In education exists in this country, in transport exists in this country, and little by little, by stealth, it started to happen also in health. So you got this idea that people will benefit from selling some of the assets of the state. And it's about how we can benefit from that. And I think there's a group of people salivating about the possibilities or less regulation, because Europe still has this idea of the welfare state. And if you talk to countries like France or Germany, those countries believe in the state, in fact, a much larger version that exists here. And they look at the United States. Some of the Conservative Party members in this country look at the United States as a possible model of how small the state is supposed to be in order to kind of function, and the services that the private companies are supposed to provide. And finally, I remember Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, who were, I think, they started the PPP, the public-private partnerships. They were the ones discussing about joining the euro or not in the first few years. And I remember Gordon Brown about talking about the five conditions. Fortunately, we didn't join the euro. But there was a long discussion at some point when Europe was starting to be very prosperous right at the beginning that, you know, Britain should join the euro. It didn't happen. But this element, I think the element of the state, it also has something to do about the regulation of the state and the role of the state within society, and the private companies, how competing with services that the state should provide.
Well, yeah, I mean, my opinion is, like, neoliberalism for me is about the takeover of the state by the corporate right. It's the privatization of the essential public services, which Adam Smith said should always remain under state control. So that's your fire department, your police, your health, your education, and your electricity and your water. Effectively, that's what he said. Mm-hmm. And the rest should be capitalism, entrepreneurship. And the neoliberal doctrine actually says, effectively, in some respects, we're running out of ideas, but we would like to get our hands on this, because it's good for us. We can run it as a private company. And when you, Blair and Brown hedged that a bit, and were very good. They gave most of the NHS a lot of money. They gave drug and alcohol services a lot of money. Yes, they still sold off elements of transport, etc., and they hedged it. But for me, neoliberalism is a dangerous ideology, because with F.A. Hayek in his book, The Long Path to Serfdom, I think it is, effectively saying that no regulation, no bureaucracy. So it sounds great, but actually, so the hard Brexiteers, in my opinion, so that would be, you know, the ERG and the Brexit Party, this is what they're about. So they want to Brexit because it enables them to turn England into a deregulated, corporatized state, yeah, in conjunction with their friends in America. And I think the Lexiteers...
It's a new term.
The Lexiteers, yeah, I know. It's a new term. It's great. A Corbyn Brexit, although he consistently says that he's for Remain and Reform, but no one seems to want to listen to him. A Corbyn Brexit or a Benite Brexit is about creating a very strong public service that we pay into that serves us. It's not run on profitable terms, and a regulated financial services and capitalism with a green bent. That's kind of my reading of it. I don't know if you think it's too simple. And I think none of that has been articulated by many people. I think sometimes Corbyn and Labour, MacDonald, maybe they try and articulate it, but they articulate it in language which is sort of still for people in the know, or in economic language. We've got our financial analysis here.
I wouldn't necessarily call myself a financial analyst. Mm-hmm. I was a quantitative analyst and a mathematical modeler, and interested in economics and macroeconomics in particular. Mm-hmm. So a number of points. The privatization issue. Clearly, that there's an economic program of a certain which leads to a certain political ideology, a certain value set. From neoclassical, conventional macroeconomics, the idea that markets are the most efficient allocator of resources, which includes human labour. And if it is the most efficient, then automatically something like government or a centrally organised control structure is less efficient. So the idea is you privatise because there will be, arguably, benefits. Of course, we see all the time when you do privatization, say, of the electricity utilities in this country, and there have been studies, for example, in Australia, comparing, comparing whether they've been privatized, whether they've not, and actually they failed to deliver. So, you know, if the markets are meant to be a mechanism where there's a survival of the fittest, of, you know, we should have tests. Okay, you've got to privatize this service. If it doesn't deliver the value, we can run some comparators. If it doesn't work and it fails, we should take it back into public control. There's a whole ideology, for example, they just assume it's going to work, and there's never think, well, did it work? Did privatizing the railways in this country, has it actually produced measurable benefits? They're all very good at producing economic indicators when it suits them, but for all these privatization processes, where the funding of these privatization of the PPP is far more expensive than government funding.
Well, it's very good for the shareholders, isn't it, Martin? It works for the shareholders, but does it work for the consumers and the users?
Well, there's more stakeholders than the shareholders, and when you talk about shareholders, when you privatizing a public monopoly, you know, we are the stakeholders, the employees are the stakeholders, especially something like the NHS, which is one of, if not the largest employer on the planet. So that has a huge effect on the economy and everyone, regardless of whether you even need any of their services. And of course, we are customers of the NHS, and obviously, you know, so there are more stakeholders than the shareholders. And so privatization, I don't specifically consider what I consider neoliberalism. It is about regulatory control, and the idea, it's really interesting. In some aspects, you want less regulation. Yeah. That's the obvious one. That's what you hear all the time from the Brexiteers. In some cases, you want more regulation. For example, the European Tobacco Products Directive. Which
financial services.
Sometimes the regulation protects the incumbents from disruptors. Right?
Martin, I got an anecdote to bring what Andrew was saying, and then a question to you, and is this. I remember Gordon Brown and Tony Blair at that time with the Labour government saying how efficient the private sector was. They were talking about privatising the air control services. Then what you have is the structures of the government, or the structures of capitalism per se, with the government at the top, in order to protect capital. When did we see that? 2008. In 2008, we protected capital big, big time. We basically paid huge amounts of money, money that we could have funded the NHS and education for years, years, not only in Britain but also in the United States, to let the financial service not to collapse. So that was subsidizing capitalism and free-range capitalism that it was. You might agree with that or not. My question to you is this. To what extent that crisis 2008 has been part of this Brexit or this kind of new liberal free market crisis that we see around the world, we see through the elections, and this divided between places in the world that benefit from this global economy and places that don't benefit. The divide between old people and younger people, the divide between urban and rural, the divide between poor and rich areas. To what extent do you think that that 2008 crisis is a big part of this narrative?
You said so many interesting things. Yeah. I want to respond to. Let me just respond to that very last characterization, yeah, the old versus young, yeah, urban versus rural, because that sounds to me like an argument that came out after the actual referendum result, yeah, when a lot of people looked at the Ashcroft polls and everyone started characterizing people to leave and remain that way. When everyone sort of missed the most fundamental insight from those polls, that has been repeated numerous other polls and various other forms of analysis, which was that when you look at in socio-economic groupings, A and B were majority remain, and C1, C2, DE, everyone else, was all leave. Now that was a much more significant to me characterization. The haves wanted to stay in the EU, the have-nots wanted to leave. Now that goes back to, yes, aspects of 2008. So in the crash, you have to also remember that not everyone did what the UK and the USA did. Look at Iceland.
Yeah, indeed.
They sent the bankers to prison. They actually, because they're in the EEA, were able to break one of the four freedoms, the freedom of capital, to introduce capital controls to protect their economy quite successfully, yeah, and it's a very, very effective technique. So that, you know, it's not everywhere that does it, but then Iceland has, yeah, a party called the Pirate Party, doesn't it?
Martin, a brief interruption, and remember that there's a connection with the UK. Many local authorities invested money in Icelandic banks at the time because they were paying, yeah, higher interest.
And the UK government bailed out all the UK exposures and failed to get back the money.
Indeed.
From the Iceland government. What tends to go on there, what happened in Greece, and also to an extent in Ireland, is when there are private debts, what you want to try and do is convert them into sovereign debts, the obligations of the state. So all these were private debt relationships between private UK institutions and Icelandic banks that were ridiculously over-leveraged. And what they wanted to do, what Iceland refused to do, was to take on that debt, whereas Greece agreed to take on the debt due to their property crash. The same in Spain. There was a property crash in Spain. There's a property,
indeed,
crash in Ireland. Less so in Greece, actually. They converted this private debt to a sovereign debt, and then they could hold the countries to ransom in various ways. So 2008, what that gate brought back was the excuse, then after bailing out the financial institutions, to say, oh, well, as a result of that, and also another point, I really have to add this in, under Blair and Brown, there's two points. I would characterise them not so much as social democrats. They most definitely were not democratic socialists. I would call them social neoliberals, mm-hmm, in the sense I can't see in many of their economic policies. And if you go back, and people forget this, the Conservatives were complaining that the Labour didn't go far enough. So it's hardly unlikely, that the Conservatives now blame Labour for the global financial crash. The global financial crash. If you hear virtually every soundbite from every PMP and every programme, yeah, mm-hmm, they're still saying, or maybe not so much today, but till about a year ago, it had just been saying it for years. They would have introduced exactly the same policies. What they may not have done was do the VAT, the cash for clunkers, as they're called in America, as they call it something different here, the VAT suspension, which is all designed to stimulate the economy. Brown, I know, but I can't say how I know, never wanted us to join the Eurozone, the Euro, and instructed the Treasury, I can't say how I know, to make sure that their analysis...
The five conditions were never met.
Yeah, but they come up with an analysis to ensure that we never joined the Euro. And that was correct, and thank goodness for that. My original interest in this was when I was trading the currencies. I've been doing it for 6 months, creating computer models in 1991. And then there was the crash of the sterling out of the ERM. And that, you know, and the famous George Soros making $1 billion in a day. It was the most, I've looked at the markets, I'm not actively looking at the markets now, it was the most obvious trade I've ever seen ever. Soros is famous for doing it, but everyone knew about this was going to happen. This is what got my interest in this topic. So the angle of currencies, and hence the Eurozone, and then hence the EU. And again, just a little aspect, we're talking about the Eurozone a lot, and of course you correctly pointed out that the UK is not in the Eurozone. The point I was making is, even though we're not, well, we're okay, we're not in the Eurozone, so what if these countries get screwed over? But it's reflective of the operational realities of the EU structures.
Yeah.
It tells you what could happen if there's other scenarios.
Well, but
that's the thing. It's not that fact, oh, we're out of the Euro. I want, you know, a better Europe would be no one in the Eurozone.
Yeah.
If everyone joined EEA, EFTA was out of the Eurozone, that would be a better Europe. I'm pro-European, hence anti-EU, but I'm not against Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. But is the volume of trade that we have with Europe, Martin? The volume of trade of this country with Europe is about, I don't know, it's 35%, correct me, you might know the figures.
Well, the actual volume of trade is more or less exactly the same as it was when we joined in 1973.
Okay, but it is.
We haven't had any. We haven't had. You know, there are various arguments in econometric analysis, but there's been no particular benefit to the Eurozone, right? To many, many countries. Italy, in particular, was doing very, very well until it joined the Eurozone. Spain followed all the correct financial guides that are actually the economic mechanisms, keeping below 60% public debt to GDP ratio, and actually when the crash happened, Spain was the best behaved country in Europe for all these things. Germany and France broke the rules all the time when they were in the recession. And you know, Spain was the best,
they carry on doing it, actually.
and Spain has suffered, so, but that's Europe. So
some pegs are more equal than others.
So. Yeah.
Well, yes, sir. If you want to bring George Orwell in.
didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, absolutely. Can I ask another question, too?
Because I've been wondering. When you talked about currency trading, I mean, it's kind of a question, but like a little bit of my own propaganda. You talk about currency trading and trading currencies. I want to know your opinion on something that I found remarkable when I read what I call one of the great books of all time, The Unconscious Civilization by John Ralston. So, and he talks about James Tobin winning the Nobel Prize for Economics for the Tobin tax, which I think now they call the financial transaction tax. And it's something like 0.5% of a tax on currency trading around the world would reap such a windfall of taxation revenue that we would almost be able to do anything that we wanted, building hospitals and all sorts of things. And that is aggressively campaigned against and stopped by the financial community and usually definitely the Conservative Party. I think George Osborne went to the European Union and condemned it. So my question would be, what do you make of that? Like a 0.5% taxation on transactions on currency speculation, etc., which can be very devastating for countries who are on the other end of it. At the same time, we can have austerity, so we can remove 60-70% out of drug and alcohol budgets, eliminate youth services, not to mention all sorts of other things with council houses, etc. But we cannot do a 0.5% tax. I have had a fund manager who operated high net worth individuals buying a $400 million into the account say, unfortunately, Andre, it would be a disaster. At that point, I had to walk away because I thought, I don't want to continue here. I'm going to get too angry. So, long question.
Okay, well, there's two things I haven't quite addressed yet, Juan, your question on austerity, which you also brought up, and let's get back to that.
Okay.
And I think this Tobin tax is an interesting way to get back into that. So, the idea of the Tobin tax is not necessarily free windfall money to fund everything else. There's a real issue about the notion of how taxes work, right? And that also goes into austerity. The idea of the tax is to stop a lot of useless, unproductive, speculative trading that's purely done for profit and to no benefit of anyone else. There's a lot of churn of transactions.
Derivatives, for example?
Sorry?
The derivatives, for example?
Well, I worked in derivatives, and derivatives can provide a very good service to a farmer to guard against weather fluctuations when he can't predict the value
of his crops. But it's highly speculative, isn't it?
Basically, if you've got legitimate businesses, whether you're an oil refinery, buying oil feed or crude feedstock, or wool farmers in Australia, you always have the problem is you're making something, it costs something now, but you've got an indeterminate price in the future, and if the price goes against you, you could go bust. So there's a whole range of different strategies and techniques. In Australia, the government has a buffer stock program to buy wool. When the price goes too low, they set a floor price, which is sufficient to keep all the wool farmers in business. And when the price goes up, they'll sell the wool stock into the market. And that means that the price won't necessarily be as high as it would have been because there's more supply than there otherwise would have been. But it keeps everyone in business. That's one mechanism. The whole idea of derivatives, of futures and forwards is essentially about someone wants to hedge. In order to hedge, a farmer wants to hedge an uncertain income in the future, so they want to sell it on now to lock in a profit now. Someone else has to be on the side to speculate. But sometimes it can be a chain from like crude oil to the oil refinery, freighting the oil from the oil field to the refinery, from the refinery after refined distribution. So it could be a whole chain. So it could be hedging.
Yes.
So that's the raison d'etre for it. What's happened is too much of it's turned into a pure speculative play. So that's a problem. But now we're sort of, it's too easy of us to move around. So going back to the Tobin tax, it's just to stop a lot of this speculation, right? So the tax, whether the number should be 0.005% or whatever it's going to be, the thing is, if it's set at the right level, it would stop all this less than 1 second transaction trading, high frequency trading, which is actually really pointless, right? What you have is a bunch of different trading groups finding an inefficiency, quote unquote, in the market and trading it and generating a nice return. Then more and more people work out this inefficiency and more people trade it. And so everyone's scalping a little bit of the profits of everyone else. So what they do is they start, in order to get the same returns, you need to have more leverage or gearing in this country, leverage in America. So you have higher gearing. You can generate if you're trading for $100 million account, but you're actually trading as if you've got $1 trillion. If you've got the right sort of equivalent of lines of credit, it's not technically that's not correct, but with all the various partners. Then you're trading $1 trillion, not $100 million.
Yeah.
And you get more and more leverage. And that's one of the main reasons, not the only reason, because there's a whole mortgage crisis. That was the cause of the 2008 crash. Banks were over-leveraged in order to produce the same returns. Now, the Tobin tax would stop a lot of this completely pointless and unproductive trading. I'm not against that as such. I don't think the level that was argued in Europe is the correct level. But I'm not against that. Now, the other aspect, and this will go into austerity, is you have to understand what actually is tax and how does it work. Because you think, do we live in a... we live actually in a spend and tax economy, not a tax and spend economy. In other words, we don't... a lot of people, this is one of the common popular, in my view, misconceptions, is we have to get the tax money in order to spend it, right? But in actual fact, in an economy like the UK or the US or Australia or Canada, where we have our own monetarily sovereign country, if we haven't put the tax money if we haven't spent into the private economy, they don't have any money to give back in tax, right? So if you look at the net financial liabilities of the whole of the UK government, we actually do something fairly unique. It could be done anywhere else. I don't know why it's not done anywhere else, but it's one of the good innovations this country's done. It's called the whole government accounts. It probably would bore most people, but it's a really good thing that this country does, where we unify the US, the UK Treasury and the Bank of England, and all, you know, the perspective of the whole of our finances. And then they have a line there, which is sort of the equivalent of what the shareholders' capital would be in a company. The, what is the value of the shareholders' capital? And it's sort of it's the taxpayers' equity, and actually the number there includes all gilts, bonds in America, and all outstanding currency, and is actually what it is. Although they've changed the definition, probably purely for political reasons, but in earlier versions of the reports in previous years, it's all taxes not. Taxes not yet collected in future revenues. All the debt that this that our country has, public debt, government debt, is essentially money that you've paid, that you've spent into the economy that you haven't yet taxed back. And why? What's happened to that money that hasn't been taxed back? We use it for our savings.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So public debt is private net savings, maybe not you and me directly, but through our pension plans, through the whole set of institutions, the whole private sector. It's our savings. We save money.
But Martin, let me put it bluntly. Are you saying that in order to be a greater beneficiaries of a tax system, we have to be better consumers? Is what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. Because now you get to consumption. One of the problems in the economy, one of the problems that happened, for example, in 2008, when we had the crash, is there's a huge contraction. You know, Keynes called it the paradox of thrift. Everyone starts getting worried that they're not going to be earning money next week, so they'll save rather than go on luxury holidays. Everyone's contracting. Businesses are changing their plans to launch products and marketing, and there's a huge contraction. And so, and the result of that is demand, aggregate demand, as it's technically called, it goes down. And if there's less money being spent on products, there's less products being and services being sold. If there's less products being sold, then there's less reason to employ people, and so you lay people off. So what the government can do is compensate for that by spending into the economy, which is what Brown did with the VAT. I can't remember the technical term for it. The cash for clunkers, they called it in America. I was in the States for a while, but I know they did that here as well. So they had these things. All these tax breaks were designed to stimulate the economy by increasing demand. There's different ways you can increase demand. You can create tax breaks, or you can actually increase government spending. And there's a number of ways you can do that. They increase demand, which means more products and services are sold, which means that more people stay employed, or less people become unemployed. So there is it's called a counter-cyclic process between what the government does and what the private sector does.
And what about this aspect of the credit? What about this aspect of the Anglo-Saxon economy, if you wish, particularly exemplarized to the house market, in which we live beyond our means, in which we spend much more money than we earn, compared to nations like Germany or, I don't know, other nations.
Are you talking about you personally? You're talking about
I'm talking about the economy as a whole. We have been told that, you know, there's a credit crisis.
Debt-based economy.
The thing is, one of the reasons that, you know, the Queen asked the famous question to the Economist, how come you missed the 2008 crisis, was because they're all focused in their models, computer generalized equilibrium models, DSG models, and so on and so forth. They'll focus on public debt. They'll focus on public debt. And so people talk about the debt crisis, right? It's public debt, it's sovereign debt, it's government debt.
Which the real problem, the private sector.
Well, some was, but regardless of that, actually, under Blair, the government was actually in surplus. In terms of its right, and so the debt was the public debt to GDP ratio was massively low. It's gone massively higher. Massively higher, but it doesn't. This is a number that's a bit like if you're trying to drive using the rear view mirror. That's not the that's not the important parameter. The important parameter is how well is our population, the citizens, doing? Are they being employed? And what's inflation like? What's the price level like? These are probably the two most important numbers. And the deficit and the debts, which is a result of the change of deficit over time, you know, the debt is the stock of money that we net owe, and the deficit is how, or the government balance, I prefer, because it can be in surplus as deficit, changes that. That these aren't actually important numbers, not for a monetarily sovereign country of a developed nation like the UK. Part of the neoliberal dialogue on ideology, and it's not just neoliberal, but certain class of economic views, generally of the right, is to make us be concerned about that. So we're concerned about reducing the national debt. The real important numbers are actually private sector debt. This is something that the Australian economist Steve Keen has focused on, although it's also a key part of the work of the modern monetary theorists like Bill Mitchell and Randy Ray. And it's the private sector debt that becomes unsustainable. And it goes back to you saying, we are living beyond our means. Yes, you and me and the private sector, we can live beyond our means. We can borrow so much money that we cannot pay it back. But when it comes to a government has different types of constraints. They are not financially constrained. We cannot go broke. We can overspend and cause inflation. That's a huge constraint. But right now, there's nowhere near that on the horizon.
In other words, you're saying when the private sector fails to a certain level, the state, the people, cannot bail them out and subsidise them.
No, I'm saying there's a counter-cyclic relationship. One of the things the state should be concerned about, and one thing that the economists who advise governments should be concerned about, and actually be able to model, and most of the ones, if they had, they would have realised there was a problem in the inflated housing prices, was private sector debt. And was it sustainable? Right?
And was I right, because we're coming to them, was I right to interpret you were saying that the taxation is used to go into the private realm to spend? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that.
I thought taxation was there to provide roads, police, schools, amenities.
That's done by the government coming up with a spending plan, the budget, and spending it, and employing people, and employing private goods sectors, goods and services, and doing its job to fulfil the social purpose, the public purpose. Some stuff is of benefit to private sectors. Some, you know, you don't want free riders, so you don't want a fire service just for people to pay for the fire service. If the house burns down next door and they haven't paid their fire insurance, okay, there's no fire service, but your house might get affected, and then the fire service will come. So there's lots of things that, you know, are for the common purpose, and they're to avoid freeloaders. The government should provide that, and that's actually, for example, the health service.
Well, that's a civilized country, isn't it?
Of course it is.
Which the aristocratic class like to often propose that. That's what we've got, a civilized society.
Yeah,
Jacob Rees-Mogg likes the idea of a civilized society, but isn't it true that he made £100 million last year and he put it in an offshore tax haven while still claiming to be an absolute patriotic lover of his nation?
Well, I think you're bringing up another point, because we're going all over
facetious.
The place.
We're coming to the end.
One of the main problems in Brexit has been identity politics, personality politics. We've been obsessed with, you know, Boris Johnson and Rees-Mogg as people and
as
what they're doing.
Policy.
And as a result, we're looking at people, not policy.
Yeah.
And that's also then brought people to fail to recognise that when you're looking at these issues, the reasons that you may have to remain or to leave, or something in between, EEA, EFTA, as my position, is you are going to have to get into bed with people of different political and economic persuasions. And instead, the personality politics means I hate those people. Those people are despicable. Yeah. You're creating division. You're creating separation, you're creating a partisan binary dichotomy.
Martin, identity politics everywhere. It has a problem, it's everywhere.
Well, it's personality politics and also identity politics.
I didn't mean to rile you too much.
No, you're not riling me at all.
I'm just saying that he's one of many characters that do behave like this. But anyway,
I'm not at all riled. I can't stand the bloke. But the fact that you brought him up just made this general point.
That's why I want to do this show. Because I want to actually talk about policy and facts as opposed to personality. cities. Because I think it's very important that we do not get swayed by charismatic, beautiful, interesting looking people.
Well, nasty,
Norwich smoke.
as opposed to actual opposed to clear proper policy. I mean, this is not modelling or fashion. This is people's lives at stake, nations' futures. And another time maybe we talk about the green industrial revolution.
Let's just try and tie this up. Going back to one point was austerity, and another point was like the economic future. One of the things about austerity, when you know there've been there's the Treasury report with all the doom and gloom what was going to happen after the referendum if there was a vote to leave, which is an utter failure. That was reflective of partly the type of economic models that was used by the conventional mainstream macro, and even within that, you know, for example, the Bank of England more recently created another set of prognostications and said what an economic disaster would result with, say, a WTO Brexit. Yeah. 2 points there. Number one, the cost to us, the loss of GDP from austerity, was already greater than even the worst prediction that the Bank of England could come up with.
There you are.
Secondly, they assume that the government would do everything as they're doing it now, which is simply impossible. So there's lots of bad assumptions in that. And I've possibly forgotten the other point I was going to make, but I just want to make that. So the austerity versus the economic disaster, what will actually happen down the road is down to our governments and down to whether, you know, if we have a prosperity budget as opposed to an austerity budget. I hate the idea of the problem with framing anti-austerity is a negative way of framing. Talk about prosperity. We can have a prosperity budget. Well, that would make all the difference whether we're in the EU or not.
Well, it's interesting what Andrew was saying, because we could have a program about the emotions. Politics is a response to an emotional state of being, rather than, you know, following facts and figures and analysing things clearly. I don't think most people do it. We just follow instinct. Things like Brexit are instinctive things. I got two final questions, one a yes, no, and the other one slightly speculative. I'm a social democrat, I prefer to think, and I like the way you define Tony Blair, a social neoliberal. I like that, and I think you are very precise with that. First question, yes or no, do you think Brexit will happen?
No idea.
And the second question, a more important one, a quick ongoing discussion with Andre. What do you think should be the size of the state, a percentage? Because I do believe in free enterprise, but I do believe that the state has to regulate certain things and provide certain services, which are essential. Education, transport perhaps, health definitely, that kind of stuff. For you, what would be the percentage of the size of the state? A 70% state, a 30%, I don't know. Just a speculative one.
I think, again, that's an indeterminate answer. And I'm not trying to...
absolutely. It's a difficult one.
It's because it's the nature of the economy, and you know, I think a lot of stuff could be actually automated, sort of be funded by the state, but actually not be part of the state. For example, within MMT, there is a policy that's the path not taken by everyone. It's already there. It's called the job guarantee. I prefer to call it basic employment. And that would be something that could be funded by the state, but wouldn't be run by the state. And so it'd be done by whatever it's voluntary organizations and NGOs and so on. So that's actually an indeterminate question. You could have a big deficit, but a small state. Okay. You could have a small deficit and a big state, depending on tax flow.
Yeah, so let's call it stumps for this evening. There is enormous amounts more to discuss, and maybe we can do other stuff in the future together. But on behalf of Juan and myself, thank you very much for coming in. If anyone is interested in listening to this as a podcast, you can get it on ztrradio.podomatic.com. And I would like to thank our director, John Anthony Richardson Productions at Instagram Paintings, for filming this, and whoever's watching and listening to it, and we can contribute to the debate in the future. But thank you very much again, Martin. Real pleasure, and I think we've got a lot more to discuss.
Yeah, I think it was a very, very, very pleasurable discussion, very interesting, and we could talk probably for hours.
Yes, indeed.
Well, you know, I'm up for things like a program on the size of the state. And I'm up for a program on things like the Green Industrial Revolution. And, you know, with your knowledge and other facts, etc., we can make that happen.
Indeed.
I'm just an opinionated no-name, you know.
Very good. That's what we need, opinionated
people.
Well,
a bit of humility is a very nice thing to have in our current society too. So, well done. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fifth Ear Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.